Hi, I'm Mike Dooley. The online article you're seeing up on the screen is something I wrote about 4 years ago. It's a profile of Dennis. And at this point, I say that this is the, here's someone who needs no introduction, but a couple of you look like you've lived through the 60s. So to refresh your memories a little bit, we're going to go through a brief bio. Well, actually, Dennis said that I can ask him that I could have the intro go on for as long as I wanted, maybe the entire hour, and Dennis could just sit on his throne and look stately. So, in that case, all right. Okay. The in case you're wondering, what any of you are wondering why a spotlight panel is on Dennis, you certainly shouldn't be. Just to quote from the article, and I do love to quote myself, I wrote, you can see it in the bottom panel there, in the 1960s underground, if the 1960s underground comics movement can be said to have a distinguished elder states, can have distinguished elder states people, then Dennis Kitchen would definitely be one of them. And growing up in Wisconsin, Dennis had been a fan of comics in general, and Harvey Kurtzman in particular. And I just heard recently on a interview he did on Bob Adelman's show, he said, Dennis said his Jungle Book was his favorite of the Kurtzman work. And like Kurtzman, Dennis has been an artist, editor, writer, publisher, and educator, also like another esteemed gentleman, Will Eisner. And a little background on his history. In Racine, Wisconsin, he went to a high school. Let me see if I get the pronunciation correct on this. It's H-O-R-L-I-C-K. How's that pronounced?
It's Horlick.
Okay.
Unless you went to the rival school and it was Horlick, you know, but
okay.
It was it was the fellow who invented malted milk balls, I think.
Uh-huh.
is this working? Is this better?
Yeah, that's better. Okay. Okay. So this is the early 60s, and while he was at Horlick High, he was co-founder, editor, writer, and illustrator of Klepto, the school's unofficial proto-underground newspaper. And University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee in 67, he co-founded, art directed, and cartooned for the university's first humor magazine, and it was called Snide. And then after he came across Bijou Funnies, a comic put out by Jay Lynch and Skip Williamson, Dennis decided to publish his own work in 1969. It was called Mom's Homemade Comics, and maybe we can find out if Dennis's mom actually did prepare Octopus Pie for him. And he got quite a good reaction from it, and one of the people that he praised what he was doing, positive feedback, was a guy you can see here with Dennis. You all know, maybe some of you won't recognize young Mr. Crumb here, but this was encouragement enough for him to go on and establish next year an alternative newspaper, the Bugle American, in which he ran weekly strips by himself and others, that were, some of which were in the Harvey Kurtzman Mad Magazine style parody mode. And he also formed Kitchen Sink Press. And Kitchen Sink's first titles included Bizarre Sex, Death Rattle, Snark, things like that, with contributors S. Clay Wilson, Trina Robbins, and Bill Griffith. And not exactly Mom's Apple Pie type stuff, but Dennis would also stick with more unpopular contributors, like there was this guy, Howard Cruz, who initially his work was reviled by, because he was doing this cutesy strip called Barefoots, and but Dennis stuck with him, and you know, too bad he never went anywhere, right? Then he went on to expand the operations on our umbrella company, Krupp Comic Works. Here's the octopus again. We've got a motif going here. By 73, he was having Harvey Kurtzman contribute covers and contents. Now look at the Kurtzman comics cover, even the woman's legs have nipples. And also Will Eisner, but this was 1973, comic sales began to plummet, and however, Stan Lee happened to come along with an offer about a comics book that we'll just mention here and possibly talk about later. But one thing I should mention as an accomplishment of the comics book is it gave overground exposure for a three-page comic strip that nobody had heard too much about at the time by someone who wasn't that well known. And then he kept up with the publishing, went on to cover new territory like your Corporate Crime comics, which was begun in 77. It actually examined the Karen Silkwood case years before Meryl Streep got around to make a movie about it, and Gay Comics broke ground on several ways. Also, it was the first comic to tackle the subject of AIDS, and Kitchen Sink was also among the first to publish that whole new generation. Dan Clowes, Drew Friedman, Charles Burns, Richard Sala, all these alternative cartoonists. How are you doing looking stately? Is it working out well for you so far? We're getting through here. Anyway, Kitchen Sink released a whole lot of old and new Eisner material. A lot of you know Dennis for that. And like the Spirit Jam strip, where dozens of writers and artists, Denny O'Neill, Archie Goodwin, Frank Miller, Bill Sienkiewicz, Brian Mullen, Milton Caniff, and Kurtzman and Kitchen himself contributed. The press also resurrected Goodman Beaver for a paperback collection, which for me, that alone deserves a spotlight. Published Kniff's, Steve Fannion, Alex Raven's Flash Gordon, strip by Ernie Bushmiller, but he did have some hardships. In 76, his local printer, who'd had no problem before running printing bizarre sets and dope comics on the presses, he decided to draw the line with Wet Satin, Women's Erotic Fantasies, which was edited by Trina. And Trina was able to help him out get a printer in San Francisco. And I interviewed Trina for the article. She said, "Oh, San Francisco, they'll publish anything." And in the mid-1980s, a little problem with the Chicago Comics shop that was convicted of possession and sale of obscene materials. This was one of the titles. And so Dennis organized a fundraiser, and eventually there was an acquittal from the appellate court, Dennis had a few thousand bucks in surplus, and with that he decided to start the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund in 1986. And there we go. And he was its president for the first 18 years. Two other success stories. This was the U.S. Customs in South Carolina seized issues of an anthology series for copyright infringement on a couple of counts. And CBLDF challenged that whole suit, and the government backed down. And at the time I wrote the article, Gordon Lee case was just popping up. He was about to stand trial, and 4 years later, finally, victory. Again, this was 2005. The Eisner Awards was giving Dennis the well-earned Defender of Liberty award. And Kitchen Sink folded in 1999. Dennis, the man who ran for lieutenant governor of Wisconsin on the Socialist Labor Party ticket in 1999, 1970, is now someone who's juggling several comics-related businesses. In fact, if you go to the website and check out Steve Krupp's Curio Shop, a web store with a variety of merchandise, you'll find that Dennis is still discovering relatively unknown artists, like Alexa somebody or other here, his daughter, and Underground Classics is a recent project of Dennis's. He curated a show on that has this book is connected with the show. Perhaps he'll be talking about that too. And he'll also be talking about comics in museums tomorrow, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So you might want to stop by for that. Upcoming current project, Art of Harvey Kurtzman. He's doing a talk on Harvey later today. Upcoming projects little sample pages from Art of Harvey Kurtzman. It's spectacular book. Really, a lot of great stuff. A lot of work that you've never seen anywhere else. The unsyndicated Harvey Kurtzman is possibly a project in process. In terms of his legacy, let me quote somebody else other than myself. Charles Brownstein, the CBLDF's executive director, said that, I quote, "Dennis has expanded the boundaries of what this medium has to offer. Without his contributions, the wealth and diversity of contents that comics now displays would be diminished." I think that pretty much sums it up. And I echo this one thing that I haven't really sufficiently covered in this slideshow and certainly in the article about Dennis. And no, it's not his obsession with Nancy. Although you may, during the Q&A, ask Dennis about the allegations of his connection with the Bushmiller Society. But what I really wanted to talk about, that all the attention he's being given as a publisher, there's another aspect of Dennis that really deserves a lot of attention. There's a project in the works right now that he's going to talk about, and I put together a little film clip on it, which Dennis hasn't seen yet, so this will be the first for all of you. So if you could kill the lights, we'll show that, and then we'll get to Dennis. And let's see on that. And if the sound is too low, please turn it up.
I'm not.
Mr. Dennis Kitchen. Lights up, please.
Well, thank you, Michael. My life just flashed before my eyes.
Did you want to talk a little bit about what we've just seen? Or a lot about what we've just seen?
Well, you know, I guess in seeing all that up there, I wonder where I had the time to even draw that much. Dark Horse is doing a book next year on this called The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen, and they said, how about a 200-page book? And my first reaction was, I didn't do enough to fill 200 pages. Now we're finding out we have to shoehorn the material in. So when I was young, I was pretty prolific. But for better or worse, there was a business side of me, and I was ambitious, and I loved the notion of publishing and publishing others' work. And so my artistic career really became secondary then to the entrepreneurial side, for better or worse, because I second guess all the time whether the right path was taken or whatever. But it's certainly nice to see this little tribute. I appreciate it. My career, as I guess Michael said, took a lot of turns, and I've been involved in a lot of people and in different movements and campaigns. So some of you may be here for different reasons than others. I'm happy to talk about whatever interests people who are kind enough to attend. But I feel like I've worn a lot of hats. And again, I have to say, for better or worse, because sometimes I wonder if I had just focused on one and just been a cartoonist, would it have been better? Or if I just focused on publishing? But I find myself pulled in different directions, and I'm not content to just do one thing. So the best thing I can say is I'm still having fun, and I've always let that be my guide. If it's interesting and it's challenging and it's fun, I do it. And somehow a lot gets done. I've worked with people over the years who have helped inspire me, like Will Eisner and Harvey Kurtzman, good examples of very hardworking guys who also wore different hats, and they were great mentors and inspirations.
So. How long has the book been in process?
The Oddly Compelling book?
Yeah.
I think we started seriously about 6 months ago. It's Dark Horse is coming out with it next June, so if you're here San Diego next year, it hopefully will be on sale.
Yeah, and these the pieces that we're seeing are the original artwork?
Yes, I think that's a portion of what will be in there. A lot of it from the early underground comics, or you saw some even regional underground newspaper covers, and even saw a couple of ads in there. And one of the things I did was get involved in the creation of a couple of alternative weekly newspapers back in Wisconsin. And I ended up doing a lot of covers and things, and as a partner in it, I had a vested interest in their being successful. So when the ad salesman would come in and say, hey, we sold X number of ads, but Dennis, you have to draw four of them by Sunday. It's like, oh, geez, didn't get paid for that, just worked late, drew the ads for them. That was part of the ad sale. So they bought a quarter page ad for $50 and included me drawing it. So the only consolation is some of them are interesting enough maybe to make the book. But that's the way it was back then. The business was not the ordinary business model. It was kind of a hippy-dippy business model. And if we wanted a newspaper, we had to sell ads. I had to draw ads to sell ads, and that was one of the things I did. And since drawing was fun, I didn't complain. I wouldn't recommend it. You start a paper that way, but that's the way it was back in the 70s.
Okay, let's find out what people are interested in. Questions? Going up, and here we go, right up front.
Well, what was it like doing alternative underground comics in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I watched a good portion of my generation flock to San Francisco and Berkeley, and I understand why. I took a perverse pride in being a hippie where I was, and I liked Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Some people would say God knows why, but I thought it was a special challenge on one hand. In other words, I thought it would be harder to stay in the Midwest and do it. It would be easier to go west and do it. And I also thought there were enough kindred spirits around me, and they ought to have their own community. And there shouldn't just be one mecca of hippiedom, if you want to call it that. So pockets began to spring up, and I certainly wasn't the only one, but I stubbornly stayed there, and I found kindred spirits, and it ended up to have advantages, because the overhead was lower in Wisconsin. Real estate, for any kind of a business in San Francisco would be a lot more. And from a practical point of view, I was much closer to the printing industry, the paper industry. I could manufacture a comic cheaper than my West Coast competitors. And there were other interesting advantages that I wouldn't have anticipated. The politics could get very weird in a community like San Francisco. And I found when I went out and visited my colleagues, there were all kinds of cliques, and one hated the other, and people were sleeping with each other and creating all kinds of Byzantine politics that it astonished me, for example, that these San Francisco cartoonists who had three publishers in their backyard would send material to me in Wisconsin. It's because I was neutral. I was not the guy who was, you know, flirting with their girlfriend at a party. I mean, it was too incestuous out there. So there were odd advantages being there, and I took advantage of them, but it certainly wasn't planned. Say it was an accident, and I think wherever you are, if you like where you are, you know, you shouldn't move just because it's cooler or hipper to be somewhere else. I thought it was perfectly fine where I was.
Yeah, a little follow-up question to that. Talk a little bit about the community in flyover country, was it Lynch and Williamson that were part of the Middle America clique that you were in?
Yeah, there was Skip Williamson and Jay Lynch were prominent Chicago underground cartoonists, and I found there were four or five others right in Milwaukee itself. So we had six, seven, eight, really, I think, first-rate cartoonists right there. And Bijou Funnies came out of that group, and Mom's Homemade Comics, and a number of anthologies. And it was great. And someone like Robert Crumb, who would pass through, he liked the guys in the Midwest, and he would come and he would stay a while. And first time I met him and we hit it off, and he said, how would you like my next comic? And it's like, okay. And it ended up selling like 180,000 copies. But the business in those days was, again, I don't know what right word it is, I'll say hippy-dippy, in that I certainly was a publisher and I loved to publish Crumb's work, but you didn't go about getting Crumb's work the way you would today, where talent is typically agented and gets shopped around the publishers, you get the best bid, etc., etc. Back then it was based strictly in relationships and reliability, and I had a reputation for being reliable, and being an artist, other artists trusted me more because I cared about things like it being reproduced properly, just dumb things like that, or it being on nicer paper. For me, the bottom line was not the bottom line. It was put out the best product, have fun doing it, and the artists appreciated that I'd use a higher grade paper or make sure the printer shot it twice if it wasn't right the first time. These are little things, but they would mean a lot to an artist, and so that's how you get a reputation. And so on paper it wouldn't have made sense for a company to start that way and to be located where it was, but I found if you develop relationships and you get a good reputation, somebody like Crumb says to somebody else, hey, he did a good job, he paid me on time, then you get the next guy. someone like a Will Eisner, Harvey Kurtzman, they could have had their work published anywhere, but they liked the fact that, you know, the production quality was there and the attentiveness, and there was somebody who shared those concerns. Not every publisher does.
Second row, had your hand up before.
What kind of problems did you have with legal problems with, you know, governments, small communities, or cities that said, "Oh my God, this is pornography," or "This is outrageous"? And how did you on your own deal with those problems from Congress?
Yeah, you know, I have to say, at the time, we kind of flaunted the fact that we were breaking all the rules. The Comics Code Authority to us was something to smash. My generation saw what happened when the Comic Code Authority came along. We saw how the EC Comics and the best stuff was driven out of business and emasculated. And so the whole point of what my generation was doing was to poke the eye of middle America and break all those rules, some more outrageously than others. We didn't at the time think, oh my God, we might get arrested or busted. When it did happen, initially, I think there was a certain amount of shock, which is, God, they're actually paying attention to us. I think we thought we'd fly under the radar. The first time there was a serious bust was in New York. It was Zap number 4 was busted. Crumb did a story called Joe Blow. And I think the subtitle was "The Family That Lays Together Stays Together." And it was incestuous, and it was outrageous. And a federal judge in New York declared that it was obscene and forbade it to be sold. So we thought, oh my God, that cast a pall over the industry. How can we go on? Well, it turns out nobody paid attention. Everybody kept selling it. Didn't matter that the federal judge said you couldn't. Shops kept ordering it, kept selling it. It was literally ignored. And at that point, we just said, what the hell? Who cares if something gets busted? What I didn't realize at that moment, and I did later when the CBLDF was started, was the artists may not have been affected. In fact, the publishers may not have been affected, but the poor retailer is the guy who takes the rap, because he's the one who's busted and may end up getting fined or jailed or whatever. And so the CBLDF largely was created to protect those retailers who are really on the front line. The artists, by and large, are immune from that. And I think we were young and we were, in many ways, reckless. And we got away with it because it was, you got to remember, the revolution was around the corner, man. And there would be different laws and rules. There was a certain... when you're that age and you're caught up in a movement, you don't think too far ahead. You were living for the moment. And at the moment, the idea of getting busted and having legal problems was too remote to deal with. And the truth is, had there been a serious legal bust of my company, I would have probably shrugged my shoulders and just started a new one, because there were no assets to speak of. You got to remember, this was all this art was creator-owned. It wasn't like Marvel or DC Comics, where we had a library of copyrights. Other than my inventory, there wouldn't have been anything to seize.
Okay, front row, you had a question?
I was curious how you went about. You were, I think I have a phrase, responsible for bringing back Kurtzman and Eisner to kind of the public limelight. I'm wondering how. Seek them out? Did they seek you out? How did that go about?
Well, you got to remember, when I was starting, there was virtually nothing being reprinted. And so I would see things accidentally. I'd discover things in, you know, old bookstores and, you know, rummage and find maybe old spirits or old meds, but you couldn't buy those collections. So what you see downstairs here today, I mean, that was just a dream. And so when I discovered Will Eisner, actually, in Harvey Kurtzman's Help magazine, and I went, wow, this stuff is amazing. Oh, I wish I could find more. Couldn't find more. So when I met Will Eisner in 1971 at a Phil Sewing convention, ironically, he sought me out, the previous panel, some of you may overlap. He was very interested in what was going on in the undergrounds from the point of view of a business model in which the artists had complete freedom and the distribution was on a non-return basis, and that artists received royalties and they got their art back and all these radical things that were very appealing to him, even though he was not part of our movement. But it was a radically appealing business model for him. And so once I met him and I had the temerity to ask if I could reprint The Spirit, he astonishingly allowed me to. And once I saw it was relatively easy to establish a relationship, then I wasn't shy. I approached others, people I admired, like Harvey Kurtzman, and in some ways were kindred spirits. And they were also, you have to understand, delighted that there was a young generation interested in their work, because a lot of these guys, they worked in an industry where it was today's entertainment and it was tomorrow's trash. And a relatively small number of aficionados were paying any attention at all. This was the infancy of this whole fan market. You know, the notion that, now 130,000 or so people will come to this building was unimaginable. The earliest conventions had like 300 people, and this preceded even them. So you just had loose organizations of fans, sometimes little mimeographed zines. It's pre-digital age, you have no email, you have no internet. So it was a very loose amalgamation. I had a distribution system that I built from scratch that mainly relied on head shops, because who else would carry these things? It was other hippie businesses. They sold bongs, they sold rolling papers, they sold beads, they sold t-shirts, and they sold underground comics. Because they were as disreputable as we were. You know, gotta remember, this was really the fringes of acceptable society. But we were kids, and there were enough of us. You gotta remember that the whole, whatever you wanna call it, the counterculture, that hippie movement, involved ultimately millions of young people. Woodstock's the most obvious souvenir of that period, but in every major city, in every college town, there were young kids who were smoking pot and who were against the Vietnam War and who were fighting for things like civil rights, and there was the feminist movement, the gay rights movement. All these things were coalescing around the same time, and so there were a lot of angry young people, and those who happened to be cartoonists took advantage of it, because good cartoonists are observers, and they basically observe society and, as Robert Crumb put it, regurgitate it back in a way that makes people uncomfortable and think. So that's what we did. And guys like Kurtzman and Crumb, Eisner and Kurtzman, were guys who were 30 years older than us, but they got it, because they were doing essentially the same thing, but not to an audience that was as obvious as ours. In other words, Eisner and Kurtzman were doing things for a mass audience, generally perceived to be a younger audience, and they had great restrictions on what they could do. So someone like Harvey Kurtzman was doing wonderfully radical things with MAD, but they still had to be restrained because they were on newsstands. Parents were already very suspicious of comics. And so these were guys who were frustrated by those limitations, and they totally embraced the fact that comics were a medium, just like film, just like literature, and they shouldn't be restrained. And so if you let creators of any kind do what they want, and, you know, then the market rewards some, and in this case, the genre was rewarded, because hippies everywhere loved this stuff. You had underground newspapers simultaneously that were very popular. So if you were a hippie, you had your alternative literature. You didn't have to buy the hometown newspaper or buy the newsstand comics. You could buy the alternatives in each case. And you see, you had a lot of regional things popping up. Comic books really just fulfilled that market. And it's astonishing, really, to think how many we could sell back then through that rickety distribution system. Because you might think, God, how'd you sell anything at all? Well, we were selling tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of comics. It was, to me, it seemed like an insatiable market. We knew nothing about marketing or advertising or any of the things you need to know now. It was driven by demand. I didn't solicit through Diamond. I just printed 10,000 or 20,000 books. I called the distributors. They'd say, send me 1,000, send me 2,000. They'd disappear. I'd print more. It was a very simple, very primitive system that responded to the market.
How did your contact with Kurtzman come about?
Well, I was a huge fan of Harvey growing up, and I had I wasn't shy, and when I did my first comic, maybe some mom's homemade comics with the kid eating octopus pie, I sent it to Harvey Kurtzman, and I said, I just self-published this, I'm a big fan, I hope you enjoy it. And in my astonishment, I got a very nice letter back from him, and he was very supportive. We became correspondents. The next time I was in New York, I visited him, and again, I found him a kindred spirit. He just happened to be older. But had he been 30 years younger, he would have been a hippie.
What about
Will? Well, Will was more conservative in that sense. I mean, Harvey Kurtzman was a guy you could share a joint with. You couldn't do that with Will. But Will was, in every other respect, young in spirit, always, no matter when Will was 87, if you could not look at the body and you just listen to the man, he was very young. They were both visionaries. They were both guys who changed the medium and influenced it in profound ways, and they connected with the younger generations always. They were never stuck in the past. Will was a guy who, when I first met him, he was doing work for the government. He was doing military comic books, basically, and his instinct was to support the government in the Vietnam War. And I remember having spirited debates with him, no pun intended. And he changed his view, not from talking to me, but just from the way a lot of the older population finally concluded the Vietnam War was a big mistake. And he was capable of that in every regard. Wasn't a guy who was closed-minded. When I first met him and he heard about underground comics, he hadn't seen them. So when he and I walked the floor of Phil Sewing's convention, which wasn't much bigger than this room, we went to a table of undergrounds, and he said, so this is what they are. And he picked one up at random, and it was the issue of Zap. He opened it up, and it was the one where S. Clay Wilson has a Captain Pissgums cutting the tip of a dick off and handing it, or eating it on a fork. And Will looked at it, and he literally blanched. His skin turned white, and he said, so this is what it's about. And I said, well, they're not all this bad, Will. There was a generational difference. He understood the freedom. When he actually saw the freedom, it made him uncomfortable. But when we talked about it later, he said, I want to do stuff like this myself. He said, he actually awkwardly at one point said, he's trying to use hippie terminology I don't understand. He said, I can't let it all hang out like rum. It's very weird hearing Will say, I can't let it all hang out. But nonetheless, he began doing things that were as you probably know, very autobiographical, very very personal, and they were directly influenced by the undergrounds. But he was never interested in doing anything remotely X-rated, sometimes naughty. But that was, I think, a generational decision. So.
Okay, there was one question from the second row, and then we'll take questions from the back of the room.
It's actually a compound question, Dennis. What precipitated the demise of Kitchen Sink Enterprises? What's your view on the industry today, on underground today?
Well, Kitchen
this
Sink...
This is a question about the demise of Kitchen Sink Enterprises?
Yeah. Well, Kitchen Sink had a 30-year run, and what happened was about 25 years into it, and I was still in central Wisconsin, and the business was changing, and there was more competition. Shows like this were certainly becoming much more prominent, and the fandom was changing, and I think in the fall of 1994, I was, since I was in Wisconsin, I was of course watching a Green Bay Packer game, and the phone rang on a Sunday afternoon, and I remember saying to my friends, who the hell would call me in the middle of a Packer game? And it was Kevin Eastman, the guy who had co-created the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I knew him casually, and he had started a company called Tundra with part of his fortune. And he asked me, he said, how's business? And I casually said, I'm burning my awards to keep warm. And he chuckled and he said, well, I'm having problems with this company I started. And he said, I have a proposition for you, and it'll either be your dream come true or your worst nightmare. And all I heard was dream come true. It turned out to be my worst nightmare. In short, because it's a long, complicated story, I ended up merging with his company and ultimately losing control. So the thing that I had cherished for those first 25 years, I gave up because I saw a chance to cash out and to grow. And it was done without proper due diligence. And that's another long story we won't go into now. But the irony is, right after Kitchen Sink went under, then, of course, the graphic novel explosion occurred, and, it is what it is. So I reinvented myself at that point, and instead of publishing the talent, began more representing them and packaging books, started authoring books, and now drawing more. So it's just one more bump in the road, I sometimes regret it occurred that way, but I think probably less likely to have ulcers because, running a business is no simple matter. And in some ways, life is simpler now, and I like that. But I also, there are days I wish, I was down on the floor behind a table and what happened. The industry today? Well, it's obviously...
Bud Plant has one-third less floor space.
I'm sorry, what?
Bud Plant has one-third less floor space.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point, because Bud's another pioneer here who, it's sad to see that his floor space is one-third less, because it tells me that Bud cannot compete effectively with Amazon.com and places like that, and it's sad. But, we all understand. Probably there are very few people in this room who haven't been tempted to buy a book on Amazon at a discount than to buy it from a Bud Plant or a local independent bookstore. And as a result, the local independent bookstores are dying and guys like Bud Plant are shrinking. So eBay's great, Amazon's great, but they have an effect on a lot of businesses who help grow this industry. There's really nothing we can do about that. I think it's sad, but guys like Bud Plant will still have probably the best and the deepest selection and the best knowledge if you're looking for things, But if you're just going for price, you'll always find a cheaper price,
Okay, other questions from the back or anywhere else? And it's okay, we got one back there.
You you think anybody that would pick up and finish the little Abner stage?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you're talking about the volumes that I couldn't finish? Yes, Kitchen Sink did 27 volumes of Little Abner when it went under. Little Abner is one of my personal favorites. I represent the estate, and I can tell you, well, maybe I shouldn't. All right, I'll tell you. It's not officially announced, but IDW will be doing them next year, packaged the same way that the Terry and the Pirates and Scorchy Smiths are. So those will be finished, and they're going to do the dailies and the Sundays in color. They're going to actually go back to the beginning. They're going to do them all, but they'll do them in volumes twice as thick. They'll be just like the Terry and the Pirates, if you like that format. Dean Mullaney, who used to run Eclipse, he'll be packaging them, and they'll be beautiful. So.
Okay, other questions in the front row?
Dennis, I'm curious, what was your thing with Nancy?
What is my thing with Nancy? Well, all right. When I was growing up, Nancy and Sluggo, for those of you the right age may remember, it was a very, very popular strip with a simple, deceptively simple style and a kind of corny, punny sense of humor. And as a little kid, I loved it. Then I grew to detest it, and then I grew to respect it again because there was something. To me about Ernie Bushmiller that was the essence of cartooning. He reduced things to the most essential. And he had certain trademarks, like Nancy's hair with the stipple, fascinated with the geometry of the strip. If you try copying it, I can tell you a lot of really good artists who try to copy it fail, because it's, that's the one I did for Playboy, so that's a naughty Nancy. But basically, I found over the years that a lot of other artists also were obsessed with Nancy in the sense of they either hated it or loved it, but they reacted strongly to it. And I found there were very few strips that people just reacted that strongly to one way or the other. And so we loosely form an organization we call the Bushmiller Society, which is I can't say much more about it because it's a secret organization, but see me later.
Okay, and back there, yes.
When you were doing some of the comics in the 70s, did you tend to use models? And if so, can you share from, you know, were they volunteers?
I'm not sure how to react to that question. No, I never use models. If you looked at my style up there, you'll see it's not particularly realistic. In fact, my young daughter, Alexa, who's a professional in the sense of being published next month by Disney, she hates my stuff. She thinks it's way too surrealistic and I should draw more realistic like her. But no, I never use models, and I try not to be influenced by other artists. One of the things underground comics always encouraged was that idiosyncrasy of style, and we love the fact that a very distinctive style, even the lettering style, the storytelling, would be distinctive in the same way. You wouldn't tell a Picasso how to paint. I never told a cartoonist how to draw, and I didn't want anyone else to tell me how to draw. So some artists use models, and it's essential to their work. I would say when I sit down to the drawing board, I have no references at all. It all just comes out of the subconscious.
Okay, I just got the sign for one more question. So who's going to be the lucky person? Okay, here we go.
The comic book legal defense fund, is that active today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if you go down to aisle 1900, the comic book legal defense fund is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's been around since 1986. It raises about $300,000 or $400,000 a year. Uses them for specific legal cases where the First Amendment is the issue. We hire first-rate First Amendment attorneys in localities where typically the people who are busted don't have the resources or the ability to fight these things. Most often it's retailers who have been accused by overzealous prosecutors in an election year, or sometimes local officials or cops with maybe a religious prejudice or some other problem, and they will bust the store, and sometimes on trumped up charges. There's a variety of things, but whenever it involves the First Amendment, the retailer has this 800 number they can call, and the fund immediately gets them first-rate legal help.
Is the retailer targeted because they're an easy target? Yeah. The publisher or the artist?
Typically, yes. Yeah, it's almost always a retailer, and the cases vary so much that it's hard to generalize. More often than not, it's in the Bible Belt, where there are people who just think, and we're not talking undergrounds here, we're talking mainstream, DC, Marvel, all comics have been busted, sometimes for very arcane reasons. We had a case in Chicago way back when the fund started where cops came into a store in Lansing, Illinois, and they arrested the guy, confiscated a bunch of comics, and when a reporter interviewed the cops, he said there was satanic stuff all over the walls, including Wonder Woman. So if you have a cop who thinks Wonder Woman is satanic, and he thinks it's against the law to be satanic, then what do you do? You can, you know, eventually you'll throw that out, but the guy who was busted may not be able to afford the thousands of dollars it takes, in some cases many thousands, to make that case go away.
And ACLU won't take the case?
We sometimes work with the ACLU, but the truth is, the reason I founded this is the ACLU initially had no interest in protecting comics. It was, I think today they would say something different, but back then they didn't think comics were worth protecting. It's as simple as that. We had no cooperation from the ACLU back in the 80s. Now we work with them in many cases. So yeah, if you're not a supporter of the fund, not familiar, go down to room aisle 1900. You can join. There are a lot of benefits to joining, but mostly make you feel good, I hope, about protecting freedom.
Okay, once again, thank you.